Davidson as your chairperson to discuss college financial aid. Mr. Davidson, please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Tanya. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this teleconference sponsored by WorkLife Connections, which is part of Digital's Worldwide Benefits and WorkLife Solutions organization. Tonight in our studios, we have three experts in the area of financial aid, and I'd like to introduce them to you and explain a little bit about how the program will operate this evening. In our studio, we have Andrea Glovsky. Andrea is with Work Family Directions, which is Digital's vendor in providing work family services to our workforce across the United States. She's Director of Education and College Counseling, and she has developed the College Counseling Program for Work Family Directions. She's been involved in education for over 20 years and is on the Board of Trustees at Lesley College. Also with us in the studio tonight is Mike Bartini. He's Director of Financial Aid Services at the College Board. He has been with the College Board for the last 15 years. Prior to joining the College Board, he was with Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia as Director of Financial Aid, and prior to that at Simon's Rock College in Great Barrington, Mass. As Assistant Director of Admissions and Financial Aid. Mike's a graduate of Westfield State College. And also with us is Ryan Williams. Ryan is Director of the Office of Financial Assistance at Boston University, just a small school here located in Boston, and has been with BU since 1996. Prior to coming to BU, he was Director of Financial Aid at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, for 5 years, and prior to that had been with the University of Rochester in a variety of positions having to do with the Office of Financial Aid and Admissions. Before going up to Rochester, he was with Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana, as admission counselor. He has a bachelor's degree from Earlham College and a master's degree in the University of Rochester, and I want to welcome you all with us today. We're going to try to really tackle this very complex subject of applying for financial aid for many people in the audience. Their children may have gotten their notices of acceptance already, or they're anxiously waiting, but they also know that they have to start submitting all this paperwork that's necessary for getting into the financial aid loop, with various deadlines coming and just getting your W-2s and doing all the different things that are involved. And what we want to try to do in the 90 minutes that we have, and really what we want to do for the audience, is to spend about 60 minutes talking amongst ourselves about this complex topic and then open it up for questions for everybody out in the audience. But to really begin to try to unravel this all and to get into as much particulars as possible about the subject matter and really get down to some of the details that may even be on the forms and some of that. We have a variety of questions that many of you sent to us by email, and we'll try to cover those during the content of the program as well as we move on throughout the evening. But I think first maybe we ought to just get a quick kind of one-on-one about financial aid. Andrea, maybe you can tell us, what is this whole thing about financial aid?
Well, first of all, what you need to understand, Bruce, is this really is overwhelming for all the parents. We get hundreds of calls from all over the country, and all of them have the same worries. The cost of college is rising every year. The sticker price can be range anywhere from $10,000 per public school education a year and $32,000 for a private school education. Many parents don't apply for assistance who earn $40,000, $50,000, and $60,000 and more because they think they automatically won't qualify because they earn too much money. What you really need to do is understand what financial aid is, what generates the figures, and how colleges approach the process, and of course, most importantly, is how one applies. Financial aid really is the assistance made available to make up the difference between the cost of college and the money that a family is expected to pay. That contribution is called, and we'll keep referring to it all night long, as your expected family contribution, or what you'll hear us say is the EFC. It's really important that you know how this family EFC is determined. There are two systems that are used in most colleges. There's a federal system and an institution system. The federal system uses the FAFSA, or what's called the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, which is available after January 1, and we'll go on and explain that further. And many colleges use the CSS profile form, which Mike will tell us a lot more about, and that's available in the fall of your senior year. And lots of colleges use their own forms for their institutional methodology. Since Mike and Ryan are both directly involved in the use of these very complicated forms, they can help us understand the driving factors in these methodologies. Ryan, it'd be really helpful if you try and give us a little bit of a picture of the federal system and the whole income side, one of our key drivers.
Sure, Andrea, let me see if I can do that in a couple of minutes sort of summary. As Andrea said, there are basically two formulas, and Mike will cover the institutional methodology side of it. As far as the federal methodology, it's important to understand that by federal law, institutions are required to use federal methodology when determining eligibility and distributing federal funds. So that's first and foremost that I think you need to understand when applying for financial aid. But specifically what Andrea mentioned are the driving factors behind the methodologies. And for federal methodology, it is really an income-driven system. And by that I mean that the makeup, the bottom line of the formula is really governed by a family's income. And I say families because it's just not the parent income that matters. The formula is going to look at both the parent income and the student income, along with parent assets and student assets. But as you get to the bottom of the formula and actually have this expected family contribution sort of put in front of you, the real driving force is going to be the income of both the parent and the student. Let me take a step back and talk to you a bit about how the income is derived. And basically what the formula is going to ask you to do is list all your untaxed and taxed income. Taxed income, of course, being the money that you've earned from wages, salaries, tips, and so on. Untaxed income being things such as untaxed portions of Social Security benefits, untaxed portions of pensions, IRA KEO contributions that you put into these vehicles in a given year, and a few others, and we can certainly go into more detail about those if there are questions. But by putting those two pieces, untaxed and taxable income, together, we'll come up with your total income. There then are a variety of different allowances that are given to the income that are subtracted out, allowances such as U.S. income taxes paid, state income taxes paid, local income taxes, as well as Social Security tax. There are also a few allowances that the formulas that parents may not be aware of, but that the formula automatically builds in. For example, if there is a family with two working parents, there's an allowance that's built into the formula to compensate for those expenses related to having both parents working. There's also an allowance known as the income protection allowance that goes into the formula that really tries to make sure that a family has the basics covered, that the family is able to provide for shelter, for housing, for possible other educational expenses, and so on. Once these allowances are taken out of the income, I'll skip over some of the formula and specifically talk about income, but once these allowances are taken out, there's something that's derived and known as an available income. And the available income is really what then drives the federal formula at the very end. It is not 100% of the available income in many circumstances, but there is a percentage that is then used in the final calculation. The percentage for a parent can run anywhere between, typically the maximum you're looking at and for income would run anywhere between 22 and 47% of what that total available income is. So let me give you just a real quick example. If you had $10,000 of available income once all of their allowances have been subtracted out, the maximum amount that would be taken from that would be roughly $4,700. And so you can see that once all of the allowances have been taken out for expenses and whatnot, it is still not yet a 100% dollar-for-dollar request from a financial aid officer or from the formula.
Now, Ryan, does the federal form or the federal calculations, are they regionalized? Because certainly it's more expensive to live in the Northeast than it is to live in Middle America or to live in some of the southern states. So when you take a look at what it costs for mortgage, what it costs for food, what it may cost for commuting, what it may cost for other kinds of housing, somebody who makes $50,000 or $60,000 in the New England area, may have certainly significantly less available income than somebody who, for example, may be in, down in South Carolina or whatever?
It's a very good question. The answer to your question regarding the federal formula is no. It really isn't regionalized, or I should say it isn't regionalized. I think the theory is that the formula takes what I would say are probably averages of the entire country, the country as a whole, and comes up with a fairly simple methodology. To regionalize it, I think it adds a bit of complexity. Now, there are probably a lot of financial aid officers and parents alike who would think that that is probably a good idea. And the institutional methodology does allow for some of that, and I think Mike can explain more of that in a second. But for the federal formula, no, it really does not do that. It's basically the same formula whether you live in Boston or whether you live in Indiana or whether you live in Southern California.
Mike can really help us know whether, you know, does profile really go into any of this? Does it help with any of this regional stuff? Or ask any other income questions?
With regard to the regional differentiation, generally speaking, when it costs more to live in an area, those people in that area make more money. So in many ways, it's a wash. There are tables that can be used by some institutions if they desire to do that, that will indicate regional differences in cost of living. But generally speaking, folks who live, for instance, in the Northeast, where the cost of living is relatively high, salaries are higher than, say, the Midwest on average. And so they generally balance out.
Maybe you can take a second and talk a little bit about what the profile is and why does it exist as compared to the FAFSA, and why is it that some colleges use the profile, which is really out of the College Board, am I right?
You're correct.
And why some other schools choose not to?
Well, as Andrea explained earlier, the profile is an independent form used by some colleges. So before you get worried that you're going to have to rush out and find out and pick up a profile application, please make sure that the colleges that you're applying to require profile. They will indicate that information in all of their publications about financial aid. So that would be the first direction that I would give someone to do. But assuming that they do require profile, the reason they require profile is because the profile form is on a different schedule than the FAFSA form. For instance, we've been processing profile applications since last September. And it collects more information and more detailed information about a family than the FAFSA does. So there are some differences, but you need to remember that institutions that do use the profile form use it for their institutional dollars. And as Ryan explained earlier, that if you're going to apply for federal dollars, which everybody should be applying, you need to use the free application for federal student aid. Let's talk a little bit more about the profile and some of the items. The first thing is how do you get your hands on a profile application? Well, students should visit their guidance counselors and pick up what we call a profile registration form. Once you have the registration form, you can see there are two ways to register for profile. First, you can call our 800 number, which is 1-800-776-6888. Or you can use our website at www.collegeboard.org. When you spell out College Board, it's all one word. Once you register for profile, you'll receive in a matter of a few days in the mail a customized application. What we mean by customized is that the questions and the forms that will be included with that particular application will be in part tailored to the institutions that you have signed up to have this information sent to. So, for instance, in Ryan's case, if you're applying to Boston University, Boston University may require certain forms that other schools do not, but you will be told in that information material what needs to go to Boston College and what needs to go back to CSS, the College Board.
You said Boston College.
Or Boston University, excuse me.
That was the September program where we had somebody from Boston College.
The next step is, once they do get their profile application, just like the FAFSA, they need to complete it. There is income sections for both the parents and the student, as well as asset sections for both the parent and the student. The important thing to remember, and to remember as well for the FAFSA, is that if the institution has a deadline, generally speaking, when they talk about deadlines, they mean having that information on campus at a particular time. So, for instance, if there is a February 15th deadline for the profile form, it means that your information has to be completed, sent back to us at the College Scholarship Service, and we have to have enough time to get it to Boston University by February 15th.
But that's true about the FAFSA, too. If they say February 15th, it also means the FAFSA is due not in the hands of Boston University, but in the hands of the government in enough time to get it serviced, which is usually 4 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks before you get that gets processed. So you've got to leave enough lead time.
So generally speaking, once you've completed the application, you need to at least give yourself a good 5 working days before that in particular party will receive that data. So don't get yourself crunched up against deadlines.
Well, given the timelines that we're talking about, if people start to fill them out in September, October, they're really doing a lot of estimating in terms of their 98 income and their 98 expenses. Is there an opportunity to correct that if people overestimated, underestimated? How does that work?
Generally speaking, the deadlines for institutions are about this time of year for regular admissions. Folks who fill out the profile form in early fall, such as September, October, they're generally doing it because they're applying for early decision. If they do make errors, they can always contact the institution regarding the information that's incorrect, and the institution can correct that. And or after the first of the year, they'll have income tax forms sometimes shortly after that they can share that information with institutions. So in the case where you have to estimate, and you may have to estimate even after the first of the year, such as this time of year, because your taxes will not be done until probably late in April, or excuse me, they got to be done by mid-April. So if your taxes are not done, you can tell I'm one who doesn't get their taxes done on time. But if your taxes are not done, but the application deadlines are coming up upon you, my suggestion is that you estimate as best and most accurately as you can.
Ryan, do you feel that way as well?
Let me give you just an example using BU as an example. We have deadlines. Let's take a step back. The FAFSA cannot be completed until after January 1st of the year you are applying. Unlike the profile form, which can allow you to actually start applying, as Mike said, as early as September and October, the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, actually cannot be completed until after January 1st. At BU, at Boston University, we actually recommend that unless you are applying for early decision, a program that Mike talked about for just a second, unless you are applying for early decision, if you're applying for regular decision admission, we actually recommend that you try and do both of them relatively close to one another, so that if, in fact, you are having to estimate because you have not yet completed your tax returns, and in many cases you are having to estimate because we're asking for deadlines around February 15th or so, as Mike said, at least the two data streams or the two pieces of information, be it the FAFSA, be it the profile, are relatively consistent. And then you do have an opportunity prior to making any kind of an enrollment decision in most cases to correcting any data that you may have to. And obviously the institution would be asking that you correct any data one way or the other. It may benefit you. At the same time, it may result in some type of a change to your financial aid award that you may not be very happy at, but at least we'll have a complete and accurate picture of what we're dealing with and what you're dealing with, so that there aren't any surprises after May 1 when you've made the decision to enroll at that particular institution.
Ultimately, though, don't colleges ask you to send a copy of your taxes? So they are going to ultimately see the bottom line.
Correct.
There's no way, you know, your estimate's going to stand, because it will ultimately be seen by the schools. For verification purposes, they're required to ask for your tax forms. I just wanted to clear that up.
And many institutions, Boston University included, go steps beyond that in requesting W-2 forms, requesting other income verification documents, and many other pieces of information or documents to verify different pieces of income and or assets, for that matter. But yes, Andrea, most institutions are going to, at some point in time and relatively soon, early on, ask you for different pieces of documentation, including 1040s, filed 1040s.
You mentioned assets. It's really important because we talked about the income side. We haven't had a chance to talk a little bit about the asset side, because that isn't ignored completely, obviously, even though we're very much income-driven in both formulas. The asset side does count, and it's very different in institutional methodology than it is in federal methodology. So maybe, you know, Ryan, you can kind of talk a little bit about the assets so we don't lose track.
For federal methodology, As I said, the assets, Andrea said this, assets play a role. The formula is income driven, but assets certainly play a role. And obviously, if we're talking about once you get to certain ranges of assets, they play obviously an even larger role. Very similar to income, there are some allowances that are given to a parent or a student within the formulas, and to allow for such as something known as an asset protection allowance. It's actually called it now the Educational Savings and Asset Protection Allowance. That will actually allow for families to set aside money for different types of requirements, such as we obviously know that at some point in time parents and are going to want to retire. So this helps set aside some money for that. We don't want to tax, if you will, 100% of income nor 100% of assets for educational purposes. But it allows them to set aside a certain dollar amounts depending on the age of the parents. The closer you are to retirement, the more of the assets that are protected. It also allows for setting aside for emergency situations. We obviously know that parents have a variety of different reasons. The roof caves in.
A tree in New England falls on the roof.
Exactly.
You've got a big expense you didn't know.
Exactly. And given this
winter, I was told that, you know, that the amount of asset protection kind of ranges somewhere for a 45, 47-year-old almost equal to their age, you know, $47,000, $45,000. It's almost close. So by the time you're $50,000, you've got about $48,000 worth of protection.
Right.
And that's a lot more money than most people that I talk to on the phone. They go, I could have $48,000 in the bank. If I did, I wouldn't be applying for financial aid.
But people certainly don't realize that the word on the street, if you will, is that by saving, having savings in assets as a saving, that you're really penalizing yourself and really taking opportunities away from your son or daughter to be able to qualify for financial aid. And as Andrea very clearly pointed out, that is not the case. In fact, there is a fairly high limit, that $50,000 or so, before the assets really start to kick in. Again, depending on the age of the parent, of course, and some other variables, but before the assets really start to play that large of a role. And I would also say, although we'll probably get to this a little later, I would also say that from an institutional standpoint and being able to choose the institution that you would like to enroll in, having savings and having those options in front of you really give your son or daughter more of an option of choosing what college or university that he or she may be attending. Even if it does have an impact on financial aid, it has an impact such that the student may not have to borrow as much during an academic year or may not have to work as much during an academic year, and opens up some other doors for them.
Well, that leads to the question that we're talking the parent assets. How about the kids' assets? There's a lot of conversation about should the money be in the kid's name, should the money not be in the kid's name, and how much does that play into some of the calculations? I mean, is it better for the kid to move the money?
That's a tough question for Ryan. Maybe I won't put him on the spot.
We get it often enough in our financial aid presentations. I think Mike, I'm sure, has a lot of input on this. The College Board and CSS has done a lot of work in projecting the impact of savings on the financial aid formula and the impact of savings on students' ability to choose. But the bottom line, or I should say, at least in terms of the numbers, let me talk numbers first. The student assets are hit fairly hard. Quite honestly, they're hit fairly hard. And the theory, of course, the philosophy behind that is that a student who has $1,000 in the bank or $10,000 in the bank, in most cases, a dependent undergraduate student, they have fewer liabilities, or they have fewer real necessities that they have to use those funds
for.
Why
else would they have $10,000
exactly.
in the bank except to pay for college? I mean, isn't that why someone puts $10,000 in the bank for a child? And that should be the argument that I make to parents all the time. But their concern is the Uniform Gift to Minors Act. This is a generation of parents who are all told 20 years ago to put all their money in the Uniform Gift to Minors Act to shelter their income. Now, that's all changed tax-wise, but these people are stuck with their income sheltered. They're talking $50,000, $60,000 of their own money, which normally would have been in assets, but some tax attorney told them 20 years, 15 years ago, you better hide it because you're going to save a lot of money, and they're stuck.
And on the federal side, those student assets are hit at a 35% assessment rate, whereas on the parent side, they're hit at around 6%. So that is very clearly demonstrates that it's not always a smart move to have those assets put away, hidden away, however you want to describe it, in the student's name. I think institutional methodology does even some additional sort of analysis or assessment of the assets. And I would like Mike can maybe talk a bit about that.
Well, the first thing I'd like to make clear is, because this is application processing time, if you have assets and you're now filling out applications, you need to report that information. This is not the time to be switching assets around. And as you'll read the instructions for either the FAFSA or the profile form, they will say, as of today, how much money do you have in these particular accounts? So you need to be aware of that. If you have younger children, you may want to revisit this. You may want to think about it. And as Ryan has mentioned, that sometimes there's tax implications that benefit the family by having family assets in the students for a certain period of time. But there are also times when those particular tax advantages can come back to haunt you, such as when you're applying for financial aid. I'm going to regress for just a second, because we were talking about income a few minutes ago, and I want to make it clear that although the way in which we ask income questions on the profile are different, when you add them all up, they are identical to the income questions, whether it's taxable or untaxed income, on the FAFSA form. So there is more There is more detail on the profile form. When we ask for adjusted gross income, we don't just ask for adjusted gross income. We ask for the adjusted gross income breakdown, all the components that make up adjusted gross income, where on the FAFSA, they ask for the one figure called adjusted gross income. Switching back to assets, assets I've tackled in a different way recently. And the reason I've done this is because I think assets are clearly misunderstood by families. Ryan explained to you that the formula is income driven, but on the other hand, assets need to be reported. From a family's perspective, when filling out the FAFSA, remember that there are only two types of assets that you have that you don't report. One would be retirement account accumulations, and the other one would be the cash value of insurance policies and annuities. So when filling out the FAFSA, if you've got an asset and you're wondering whether you should report it or not, if it's not a retirement account cumulative value, or if it's not the cash value of a life insurance policy or annuity, you should report it somewhere on the FAFSA. You shouldn't duplicate either. Many times it's confusing to determine whether it's one item or another item. You should only report it once. When you move to the profile form, the only additional item that you'll be including is the home value. And we ask that question in such a way as we ask the current value of the home, we ask the debt against the home, and that determines the equity in that particular home. So when reporting assets, I think many times families fear that if they report these assets, they're going to have to sell their home or they're going to have to dilute all of their assets, when indeed that's not the circumstance. But the similarities between the FAFSA and the profile form, I think, are much closer than what many families recognize.
Are you going to ask everybody what kind of car they drive or what kind of boat they own or whether mother has a diamond ring or what other assets they have? I mean, do you care on that profile? I know the federal government doesn't care, but how about the colleges themselves?
One of the interesting parts about profile is that beyond the standard core questions, we have a set of questions that institutions can require based on what they need at their particular institution. And some of those questions deal with other family assets. And so in some cases, you may receive a profile form that has what we call a Section Q. And a Section Q is a group of questions that institutions are going to ask individual families to answer, and they may be beyond the standard core questions.
Like, what kind of cars do you drive?
Like, what kind of car do you drive?
Because I get people calling me up very upset. They want to know what kind of cars we drive. And I've always struggled with trying to explain why. But it's up to each individual school as to which of those questions they choose.
That is correct.
Is that a good rationale for waiting a little bit to apply for profile? Because if you don't know what schools, you could be premature in filling out your profile application. But if you wait till you have your list of schools complete, then you won't miss any and have to go back and redo? Or I mean, I'm not sure about that.
At this time of year, I'm always worried when someone says I might be waiting a little bit longer, knowing that the majority of deadlines are approaching. So the first thing to recognize is that if you've got a list of profile schools right now, or for that matter, if you've got a list of FAFSA schools right now, and the earliest deadline's coming upon you, my suggestion would be is to make sure you file that application.
I'm concerned about the ones in the fall when people say, well, I'm just going to fill it out because I want to know. Isn't it better to wait till they get their list, till January, till they actually, as you said, comparing the two income statements so they match?
I would suggest that you need to do it no sooner, start the process no sooner than 4 weeks before your earliest deadline. Right. That would be plenty of time.
I want to go back and digress about the comments on the assets and the value of the homes and so forth, because I'm a little confused or somewhat curious as well. Is it an advantage or disadvantage for families to have overbought in their home, be mortgaged up to the hilt, and have bought a $300,000 home versus the family that perhaps was a little bit more conservative because they wanted to be able to squirrel away more money for education? How does this balance out? I mean, what's the fairness doctrine? Do schools look at those asset values against the geography and kind of say, well, gee, this is interesting?
One of the issues with financing higher education is the dichotomy between the family who saved and the one who didn't save. Or if you want to look at it from an asset perspective, the family who has a lot in home equity, but the other family who doesn't have anything in home equity. As Ryan indicated earlier, those assets need to be reported, and they will affect your family contribution, meaning if you have assets and somebody else doesn't, chances are if everything else is equal, your contribution is going to be higher. But the one thing that it does mean is that you probably have more choices. When it comes down to choosing institutions, the type of institution that you'd like to go to, the amount of money that you might want to limit yourself to with regard to student loans and parent loans, you're probably going to have more options if you have assets that you can use for those particular educational purposes versus not having those assets. A good example is that in many cases, the family contribution that's expected from some families certainly can't come out of current cash, nor in many cases do we expect them to do that. But those families that are mortgaged in such a way that they can't afford to take on any more debt have lost pretty much all their options with regard to how they might foot that bill come next fall. So yes, you do get taxed more if you save, in the end, I think it benefits you because your options are going to be broader for you.
So it really comes down to the options that are then become available to your son or daughter, because there's no way the institutions are going to make up all the shortfall.
There are very few institutions, I think, who can, do that. I mean, there are as many different awarding policies and theories around this country as there probably are institutions. Some institutions have plenty of funds. I guess I use the word plenty relative or cautiously. It's never enough. But many institutions, particularly here in the Northeast, have a fairly sizable institutional funding ability, and then there are many institutions who do not. So as Mike was pointing out, in terms of your options, you may find yourself being limited to institutions where there are fewer options for you in terms of the types of financial aid available. You may find yourself borrowing more. Parents may find themselves borrowing more because they cannot make up the family contribution in any form out of current income or out of the assets that that they have. And so not all institutions are going to be in a position to make up the difference. I mean, it really is a partnership, we believe, in my financial aid office anyway, that it truly is a partnership between the institution, between the family, obviously between state and federal governments. But first and foremost, we're going to be looking towards the parents and the family to be able to contribute their share. Oftentimes, we understand that the figures that we come up with are not, they're not written in stone, and they're not always going to be as easy to come up with as the formulas may indicate. And we're certainly willing to and wanting to understand that. But first and foremost, we're looking to the families to contribute their shares, and then hopefully between the institution and other agencies, organizations, the federal governments, the state governments, then can sort of pick up the pieces.
It's interesting because I learned from the College Board some time ago when I first started learning about financial aid that it is not the willingness of the parent to pay, but it's the capacity of that parent to pay over time. And parents think, well, I just can't come up with $15,000. Maybe they can over a 10-year period by borrowing it. And that's what a college is looking at. And that's what I learned from the College Board many years ago when I first learned how to do financial need analysis. And it's really important for parents to understand. It's not today's dollars. Very few people could sit down and write a check for $30,000 per BU after-tax dollars. I mean, it just, there aren't a population in this country could not support that. But it, can they pay the $30,000 over 10 years? And I guess that helps parents see that aspect of it. We forgot one thing. And that's the debt piece. Bruce, you were going to bring up that question.
Well, I was going to ask that oftentimes there's extraordinary issues. We talk about the debt in terms of mortgage debt. But what would a family do in terms of having extraordinary circumstances, such as one of the children, one of their other kids are in private school, or they've been sending their child to private school, they've incurred debt around that. They have daycare expenses. They may be caring for an elder a parent in the home or outside of the home, or a special needs student, or somebody who's dependent because of disability. Where do those come in? Do they? I don't remember seeing those kinds of questions on the profile. You know, where can the parent talk about those debt loads that are real and may even impact their ability to get loans through other sources?
For the most part, I think those kinds of issues would be something that financial aid administrators, high school guidance officers, the people sitting around this table would encourage a parent or a student to communicate directly with the financial aid office or the financial aid administrator. There is some space on some of the forms to allow you to make certain special circumstances known to a financial aid officer or a financial aid office. But for the most part, my recommendation would be that you communicate directly with the financial aid office, with the financial aid officer, by phone, in writing, by visit, and make sure that he or she understands what those special circumstances are. There are many extended families these days. We have grandparents living in households with their son and daughters taking care of and helping supplement them. We have a variety of different medical issues and things that parents and families have to deal with throughout the course of the year. And so even beyond what you were just describing, I think as if and when circumstances change, hopefully they change not for the worse, but if circumstances were to change during an academic year, I would encourage a family to communicate to the with the financial aid office as well regarding how circumstances may have changed. In this day and age, it's not unforeseen that a family, a parent, or may lose his or her job during the course of an academic year, and that's information that certainly a financial aid office should be aware of.
We've been talking about the family and, in a sense, the traditional family. How about what really is a very much representative major population are single parents? We have custodial parents. We have the non-custodial parents. How do people approach the forms and filling out the forms from a custodial parent point of view? And what is the obligation to submit information for the non-custodial parent who would be being paying child support and alimony and so forth?
It varies from institution to institution for the most part. The way the FAFSA, anyway, would direct a parent to complete the form would be primarily looking at who the custodial parent is. With whom does the student live? Who has provided the most financial support? And that parent in a divorce situation would be the one to complete the actual FAFSA form. As far as the profile form is concerned, for the most part, the same definition would go. However, most institutions then want a supplement with the profile form known as a non-custodial parent supplement, which then would also go into some detail about that non-custodial parent. Most institutions, in order to award their funds, want to be aware of the capacities or the abilities of the non-custodial parent in a divorce situation. Federal form, on the other hand, is going to be primarily based on the custodial parent's income and asset information.
And the possible step-parent.
And possible. So very
we
good
can't
Andrew.
Leave that point out because that's something parents don't understand at all. This parent contributes nothing to my child's support. Why are you asking me income and assets about that person? And that's a real concern to parents. And I try to explain to them that the person, the step-parent, is providing food, clothing, shelter, and care of the family. And that's why they're included.
Mike, is that true? Is that the way the profile fits in?
The profile works the same way. One thing I'd like to go back and talk a bit about, if you think you've got an unusual circumstance, whether it has to do with your family makeup and or some circumstances, Ryan talked about passing that information on to institutions. Right away, I can see families are scared to death. Oh, I'm applying to 8 institutions. That means I've got 8 different letters that I've got to write to institutions. Rather, what I would suggest is for you to put your circumstances down on one letter. Make sure you put the student's name on the letter, the social security number of the student, and share that same letter with all institutions. This way here, you can photocopy it. You can be very efficient in distributing your family's circumstances to those institutions, and they can respond accordingly. So that's one suggestion I have.
Great idea. I never thought of that suggestion, Mike.
Word processing is great, but still, you know.
What are we looking at in terms of the timelines at this point? Where some of the deadlines are lining up at this stage and before we get into phase 2 of the program tonight. So what are the kind of dates and things that people ought to be paying very close attention to? And even on the average, I mean, we talk about the schools looking for FAFSAs and deadlines. What do you think's out there? Ryan, you work with other schools as well, not just BU. You know some of your colleagues out there. What's the average span at, for the freshmen, and maybe if we have some parents who are sitting there with sophomores or juniors that are talking about renewal packages, what kinds of deadlines should people be anxious about or not anxious about at this stage?
We touched on some of those dates a little earlier, but let's sort of put them in chronological order. Right now for the freshman process, as Mike and Andrea and others we've stated, for the freshman process, most institutions are going to be asking that you complete the financial aid application process somewhere around that February 1st, that February 15th, that March 1. I mean, it's typically going to fit somewhere in in February, and probably the majority probably center themselves around February 15th. And that is, as has been described, and that is so that the institutions have on hand, be it the FAFSA form or the FAFSA information, as well as the profile information, so that it can be reviewed and decisions can be made. Now, that timeline is such so that we can make decisions in the financial aid office at a point in time to where students are finding out from their college of choice admissions decisions. If you hear from Boston University, an admissions decision, you've been admitted into the class of, I think we're coming up on 2002 now, you've been admitted to the class of 2002, we want to make sure for those of you who are concerned about financial aid and financing that education that you have within a relatively short period of time, often it's in the same envelope, or within a day or two following, but we want to have you get that letter of admission and also at the same time or shortly thereafter be able to make some financial decisions. So February 15th or so is typically what most institutions are looking at in order to have completed data on file.
We also hear some schools do first come, first serve with their money, and some schools use it all up. And if you come in March 1st or March 15th, there really are only federal funds left. So, that's an issue.
Andrea just described, Boston University to some extent in that we have a relatively large population of families and students who are applying for financial aid. Therefore, we have to set, and many institutions do, have to set some relatively stringent deadlines. And at Boston University, we'll try to award funds to needy students as long as we can. But at some point in time, as our class begins to fill up after May 1, and decisions are being made, there has been points in time in the last year or two that I've been at Boston University where we've had to make some decisions around late April and early May that we just don't have the funds to award any longer, and missing a deadline here and there can really impact your ability to receive funds.
Now, for returning students, sophomores or juniors, the deadlines are different, am I right?
The deadlines are different for returning students, so the good news here is that most institutions have the ability to communicate with them directly today with email on campus and all the campus notices that they can put in a student's mailbox. Students should be well aware of what their requirements are for their second and third year, and if they're not, it only takes a second between classes to stop by the financial aid office and pick up material appropriate.
I'm laughing.
Famous last words, I'm sure.
In my office, it only takes a second.
Why don't we take about a 30-second break while we switch tapes and take a breather, and we'll be back to you in just a moment.